This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In the U.S. right now, we're having another national conversation about guns, gun rights, and gun restrictions. But there's a lot of confusion about what the landscape of gun laws actually looks like, and even the terms we're debating. When you hear the word assault rifle, do you know what that actually means? Do you know what the definition is? Do you have a definition? Do you know the difference between automatic and semi-automatic, between a clip and a magazine? Do you know what the gun show loophole means, how private sales are regulated from one state to another, and why you don't need a permit to carry a gun, even a concealed gun, most places in Vermont? When we talk about guns and gun laws, what do we actually mean, and are we all speaking the same language? Tristram Coffin is a former U.S. attorney for the District of Vermont, now an attorney for Downs Racklin Martin, PLLC, in Burlington. As U.S. attorney, he prosecuted firearms offenses and had to learn the federal laws related to guns. He also knows a lot about Vermont's laws. Tris Coffin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
Do you think we're all on the same page when we talk about guns in this country?
Well, it's a big question, and it varies. I think in some ways we're on two different pages, and then in some ways we're on a lot of different pages in terms of kind of the minutiae of the different types of laws and the real patchwork of laws that cover this issue. But you know, there's some people who are on the page of there shouldn't be any regulation at all of firearms, and then there's some people who are on the page of we do need some regulation. So in that regard, we're on pretty consistently on two different pages.
I'd love for us to go through some of the laws that are in place federally and state laws and what, you know, how different it can look from state to state so that we do all have some shared understanding of what we're talking about. Listeners, I welcome your comments as well. I know many of you are very educated on these issues and have, as Tris Coffin mentioned, very polarized opinions, but there's also opinions that are somewhere in the middle and people coming together on things that they can agree on. So I'd love to hear your thoughts or your questions. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So, Tris Coffin, in terms of federal law, who can buy a firearm?
Sure. Federal law sets out a broad class of people who can buy firearms, basically anyone over 21 who doesn't fall into certain categories. And those are people who are have been convicted of crimes punishable by more than a year in prison, people convicted of misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence, people who've been adjudicated mentally incompetent, people who are substance abuse users, and people who are under indictment.
And how do they know people who are substance abuse users?
Well, when one goes in – and by the way, those are the people who can buy firearms, but that's typically done with a licensed firearm dealer.
So what's often termed an FFL, federally
firearms. Exactly.
Yeah.
So the way it works is someone will go to a if they're going to buy from an FFL at a gun shop or an FFL at a gun show, they will be required to fill out what's called an ATF form 4473, which is a form that requires you to sign under penalties of perjury that you don't fall into any of those categories, and also that you're from the particular state that you're buying the gun in. Once that form is done, the gun store owner, the FFL, will run that through what's called the National Instant Background Check System, which is also known as NICS, and will check to see if you have a disqualifying criminal record or if there happen to be records in those other categories that prevent you from legally getting a firearm. If that check comes back clean or doesn't come back within a certain period of time, the sale is required to go forward under federal law.
And again, for the substance abuse, that's based on legal things that you may have gone through?
Yeah, well, it would be, you know, one would have to admit that they're currently
so
a substance user, but if one were to check off I'm not but really were, then you would have a problem there that may not be picked up in
So that's sort of self-reporting, basically.
It's kind of self-reporting, but there could be other information that could come out. But the National Instant Background Check System focuses primarily on criminal convictions and to a lesser extent mental health adjudications.
And are states allowed to put additional restrictions on who in their state is allowed to buy a firearm?
Yes, they are. There's a practical impediment of that states don't have in their own systems to check these things typically, and they tend to piggyback on the NICS system, the national system. So if the national system isn't picking up whatever category the state wants, it may not get picked up.
What does a federally licensed firearm dealer have to do with the information that he or she has collected, that background check?
An FFL will be required to engage in some fairly rigorous bookkeeping. They need to document the sale, enter it into a register that they keep of historic sales of who the purchaser was, the serial number of the gun, the date, and so forth. And they'll also be required to preserve that form 4473. So if, you know, down the road somewhere the gun turns up at like a crime scene or some other dangerous place, the gun will have a serial number on it, and they'll be able to trace back in theory to see where that gun was purchased. The problem with that, of course, is that we're just talking about sales from gun stores here. And essentially unregulated are sales from private individuals. And that breaks that chain of tracing. And so that can only take you back so far often.
Right. You only have essentially that original sale, that record of original sale. And what happened with the gun in between may be a completely unknown area.
Exactly.
How is that different, though, than a registry, than a gun registry?
What do you mean by that?
Well, if a federally licensed firearm dealer, if an FFL has the serial number and the purchaser's name for every gun that is sold by that licensed dealer and has to keep that on record, when we talk about the idea in this country,
a national gun registry. Well, interestingly, despite our advances in technology, the law prohibits ATF from making a central composition of that information. So even though we have, you know, central repositories of all sorts of information, one of the things the law prohibits is the ATF or the national government from having that information set in one area. And
so BJ's Gun Shop has a record of its own. Dick's Sporting Goods has a record
correct.
Of its own, and it's not all centrally located anywhere.
And to get that information, somebody has to actually physically go to each of these places where the records are kept, the individual gun shops or the individual dealers, and collect and accumulate that information.
Must
very
they also
laborious
have a subpoena?
Situation.
Do they have to have a subpoena to do that?
It depends on the situation a little bit, but typically they will need a court order or a subpoena to get that information.
You mentioned that we're talking here about federally licensed gun dealers. So this can be a store, or sometimes individuals do have FFLs, the Federal Firearms License. This was one of the issues that came up yesterday as U.S. Senate Democrats filibustered for nearly 15 hours in favor of stricter gun control. Democratic Senator Christopher Murphy of Connecticut started speaking after 11 a.m. yesterday, and the filibuster ended just after 2 a.m. this morning when GOP leaders agreed to allow votes on two gun control measures. Among the Democrats who signed up for a slot to talk was Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy. And we're going to hear a comment from his, but I want to mention that following the rules of a filibuster, he had to phrase his remarks in the form of a question. And so he addressed Senator Murphy as he spoke.
Is the senator aware that today you could have three murder warrants out for you, a conviction for armed robbery, and walk to a gun show and buy any kind of weapon you wanted without having to go through any background check or have a license?
So, Tris Coffin, let's talk a little bit about this, what happens at a gun show and what's often talked about as the gun show loophole.
Mm-hmm. Sure. The gun show loophole is a little bit of a misnomer, because really what you're talking about is sales from FFLs, be they at a gun show or more commonly in a gun shop, a gun store, or sales from non-FFLs. FFLs, federally licensed dealers, have certain rules they've got to abide by. They can't sell to those prohibited people. They need to do a background check. Private sales, they're supposed to do things like the rules are they can't have a reason to believe that somebody is disqualified, but they don't need to require them to fill out the form certifying that they're not prohibited, and they don't need to do a background check. So the gun show loophole is meant to really describe the gap in the law that doesn't cover private sales. And you can sort of understand how some private transactions maybe would be too laborious and cumbersome to cover. You know, grandfather wants wants to give his favorite hunting weapon to his daughter, and as a family tradition, you know, maybe we don't need to do a background check on the 16-year-old daughter. But there's a huge gap, and I think the article that Paul Heinz wrote in 7 Days that came out today did an excellent job of showing how sales off of the internet are not regulated in any meaningful way. And in a really short period of time, somebody who could be completely disqualified under federal law from having a firearm could have one provided to them, delivered to them in the parking lot of a Five Guys, for example.
Yeah, because the private sale doesn't require this background check, a private
Correct.
Individual. And we are going to actually speak with Paul Heinz of 7 Days in a couple of minutes, and he can describe what that process was like. If you haven't read his article yet, we have a link to it at vpr.net. We're talking with Tristram Coffin, former U.S. attorney for the District of Vermont, and we're going through some of the lexicon around guns. We're talking about some of the rules around guns. And if you have a question about what's actually on the books in Vermont federally when it comes to guns, if you want to share your thoughts on what you'd like to see happen as we continue this national discussion, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Tris, you mentioned sales over the internet, and I want to clarify one thing. So the initial point of contact can be over the internet. You can have a conversation about a private gun sale over the internet. My understanding, though, is that you are not allowed to just ship a gun to another individual who you've talked to over the internet to that individual's home. When we talk about actually mailing guns, those have to be mailed to an FFL. But so these private sales are face-to-face interactions.
That's correct. It's sort of like a Craigslist sort of a thing where typically somebody will exchange, you know, the gun will be posted on an internet website for sale. There'll be email traffic between the person posting it for sale and the would-be purchaser. They'll may have some independent negotiations, and if they agree on a sale, they'll meet somewhere and the sale will happen. So they are not supposed to sell from people that they understand to be from outside of the state that they're in. They're not supposed to sell to people who they understand to be prohibited. But there's no real way to regulate that, and that's what's of concern.
And in Vermont, my understanding as well is that the main operator of the big gun shows that occur here every year has voluntarily said, we will require background checks for any sales that occur within the gun show. But that's a voluntary requirement, not a state one.
Sure, that's a voluntary requirement. It is only that gun show and other gun shows that choose to engage in that type of action. And there's really no, to my mind, oomph behind that that's reasonable given the type of product we're distributing here.
We got a question from Barbara in Huntington who says, what's the youngest legal age for purchasing a gun in Vermont? I thought it's 16, she says.
It's 16 for long guns, 21 for handguns. I think I said 21 before.
Nathan says, I think it's important to be specific and correct when we talk about assault rifles. Many people have been postulating online this week about assault rifles, and many are inaccurately referring to AR-15s as assault rifles. Just to be clear, an AR-15 is not an automatic weapon. They are semi-automatic, which means one trigger pull, one bang. All right. So there's a couple things here in Nathan's
Sure.
comments that maybe we can tease apart. One is, what is an assault rifle? This is something that is often talked about, and I don't think everybody has a clear or the same definition.
Right. You know, and the exact precise definition depends on sort of the semantics of the people using it. For example, in 1994, the assault weapons ban talked about a ban of assault weapons in the legislation. There's come to be this nomenclature of what's called assault style weapons, meant to distinguish, as the caller correctly did, between fully automatic military weapons and what are basically kind of copies but are semi-automatic. And let me talk to the listeners about what that distinction is. An automatic weapon is what we would refer to as a machine gun. You hold the trigger down and it shoots as many bullets as the operating mechanism will allow until you release the trigger. A semi-automatic weapon shoots only one bullet per pull of the trigger. Now, one thing that's important, two things that are important. One, modern semi-automatic weapons, many of them, have such a hair trigger that really, even though it's one pull, they can put out a remarkable number of bullets in a short period of time. The second thing is, unfortunately, there are many kinds of conversion kits available for many types of semi-automatic assault-style weapons, which can convert them into fully automatic relatively easy.
Which is illegal.
Which is illegal.
But is often done.
I can't say how prevalent that is. It's something that is not that difficult to do. It depends on the type of weapon. But the kind of underground kits that are available on the internet and so forth that are really dangerous. And fully automatic weapons, one can possess them, but have to go through a very, very extensive background check and licensing process before one can get that, because they are so powerful.
Yeah, and let's point that out as well. There is a common misunderstanding that assault, or that fully automatic weapons are completely banned, and that is not the case. In Vermont, for example, you are allowed to own a fully automatic weapon. I think they've been grandfathered in, right, certain ones of them, but you do have to go through a much more extensive process.
There's a federal licensing process that you can go through to get it that's quite elaborate. But you can do that.
As we're talking about this, I'll read a note from Michael who says, the AR-15 and other assault-style rifles are semi-automatics with no functional difference between them and many other legal rifles except for appearance. Because they look dangerous, the uninformed believe that they are more deadly than other guns, which they are not. Trying to address crime by banning assault rifles makes as much sense as addressing traffic safety concerns by requiring cars to have round instead of square headlights. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that goes too far. Like it or not, these weapons seem to have become somewhat of the weapon of choice for the tragic number of mass killings we have. A assault-style weapon was involved in what happened in Orlando, Newtown, Aurora. And the caller has a point that, you know, to some degree they're not really different, but there are a couple differences. One, these rifles can have large capacity magazines attached to them. And really, you know, that part of them makes them, I think, particularly dangerous. Someone can have, instead of a six-shot revolver or a 11 rounds in a common semi-automatic pistol, they can have a 30-round magazine, and they can put an amazing amount of firepower out very quickly. The other thing I would say is, you know, indeed, these rifles, different than hunting rifles and different than handguns, really are intended for use in war. And the design features, while individually may not make a lot of sense, when you put them all together, they result in a package that is able to be wielded in a way that is pretty effective at really hurting a lot of people in short, medium ranges in a short period of time. And unfortunately, that's been shown pretty tragically. The last thing I'd say is this. The round they use, the .223, is a round that is specifically used in military weapons. And there's a lot of commentators who will describe that round as particularly adept at destroying flesh. And that's why it's, you know, unfortunately suitable in a war zone, but also maybe why it's not so suitable for to be so commonly available to civilians. So I would take some issue with the caller's point that these assault-style weapons are really sui generis to other kinds of weapons that there may be more broad use for in our society.
If, however, our law as it stands right now allows for self-defense, why wouldn't you want a bullet that does that? If part of what is allowable in this country is to have a gun to defend yourself, which may mean killing another person, why wouldn't that bullet be appropriate?
Well, I think you need to look at the realistic self-defense scenarios. And I'm not aware of situations where people have needed a 30-round clip with special magazine or special ammunition to protect themselves. That seems to me counterbalanced against the demonstrative incidents that we've had, unfortunately, in our society again and again and again, where these things have been used to cause huge mayhem.
And maybe you should also define what a magazine is. I mean, if somebody's picturing a gun and that you put the bullets in the gun, a magazine is something that attaches to the gun and can actually allow those bullets to feed in differently.
Sure. And Jane is doing a very nice visualization with her hands here. This is it's a container basically that holds the bullets and clips into the gun. Pistols, the magazine tends to be in a semi-automatic pistol, tends to be in the handle of the gun. These semi-automatic assault-style weapons, the clip tends to attach below the receiver and frame of the gun.
More questions still to come and more of your thoughts, listeners, as we get into some of the philosophical questions here, as we look at what you're thinking in this conversation. We're trying to sort of define the terms, make sure that we're all understanding the same things when we talk about guns, and then when we move on to things like what kinds of restrictions could this country put in place, could this state put in place. I'd like to hear your thoughts. You can post them at vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition, or call 1-800-639-2211. Coming up, we're going to hear from columnist Paul Heintz of 7 Days, who wrote about his attempt, a successful attempt, to purchase a weapon earlier this week. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Tristram Coffin is a former U.S. attorney for the District of Vermont, now an attorney for Downs, Rackland, Martin, and Burlington. He's with us today helping to explain the landscape of gun laws in Vermont and at the federal level, and some of the definitions we hear about so often when we have conversations about guns, gun rights, and gun restrictions. You can share your thoughts on what you think is appropriate to legislate on guns. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. In a moment, we're going to be speaking with columnist Paul Heintz of 7 Days. But first, let's go to Mark, who's calling in from Northfield. Hi, Mark. Go right ahead.
Hi there. I just have a couple of quick comments. Mr. Coffin, when you say that the AR-50 or assault-style weapons are being manufactured with these hair triggers, that's just ridiculous, and it's just not true. It's absolutely not true. The other issue I have is, you know, when you're talking about the 5.56 or 223 round, essentially NATO went to using that because it allowed troops to carry about double the ammunition they could if they were carrying the traditional 7.62. It's not actually a particularly robust round. Any bullet will cause enormous damage to human flesh. And, you know, the reality is that bigger rounds with more kinetic energy behind them will cause vastly more damage. And the other thing is, AR-15 was originally designed, actually AR-10, as a target rifle. It wasn't originally designed for combat. Thanks. I'll take the replies off the air.
Mark, thanks for your comments. Appreciate that. Triscoffin?
Sure. Well, like it or not, those seem to be the guns that people are choosing for some of these really horrific mass killings. And, you know, I hear your points on that. My sources of information tell me slightly different about those things. So I guess I would just sort of agree to disagree on that. But, you know, I think still the point out there is they are able to put out a tremendous amount of firepower. The extensive magazines that they have allows people to really, unfortunately, do, you know, significant mass killings. And I just don't understand what the counterbalancing need for people to have those is when there's so many other options that nobody is talking about at all, limiting for a sportsman or personal defense or whatever.
To Mark's point about what is a hair trigger, I mean, I guess that's a semantic argument, what you think a hair trigger is versus what Mark thinks a hair trigger is. It seems to me the main point here is that it doesn't take much effort to pull a trigger on certain semi-automatic weapons. So it's pretty easy to keep pulling that trigger very quickly. It's not something that you have to reload. You don't have to press another button. When you pull a trigger, it pulls very quickly and with very little resistance.
Sure. And I think that, you know, some of the video and the sound from Orlando, for instance, showed a lot of gunfire going off. I imagine some of that was fully automatic, but some of that was semi-automatic too. And you could see the amount of firepower that happened there.
One of the areas of gun regulation that has already come up in the gubernatorial race in Vermont is this question of private gun sales in the state, something we were talking about earlier in the show, and the fact that background checks are not required for sales that one private individual makes in person to another. In a recent article for 7 days, political columnist Paul Heinz highlighted this fact by going to purchase a gun from a private seller. His provocative headline, "How I Bought an AR-15 in a Five Guys Parking Lot," has triggered a lot of conversation, and he joins us now for a few moments to explain the process he went through. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Jane.
So why did you think, I'm going to go buy a gun and then I'm going to write about it?
Well, in the wake of these mass shootings, we often hear a lot about how easy it is to purchase guns similar to the ones used in the shootings. So after the Orlando massacre took place, I figured, well, I'll try to find out how easy it is here in Vermont. So I just basically Googled the words AR-15 Vermont. And the first thing that popped up was one of these websites, very similar to Craigslist, that lists a number of private sellers. I contacted one of the first people I saw listed on there on early Monday morning and basically said, hey, is this gun still available? I'd like to buy it. So I went back and forth with this gentleman throughout the morning, and I made clear that I wanted the gun ASAP, and I made clear that I wanted it to be in shootable condition when I bought it.
You also made clear that you weren't prepared to show photo ID.
That's right. At one point, the gentleman said, well, can you bring an ID to, you know, this place where we're going to meet to exchange the gun for the money? And I sort of pushed back and I said, well, would it be something along the lines of I'd rather not bring an ID? He responded and said, that should be fine as long as you look of age. I was very surprised when he said that. I kind of thought that, you know, when he said he needed my ID, I thought, oh, wow, maybe he will do a background check of some sort. You know, maybe I didn't know how that would work. Anyway, he suggested that I meet him at 5 o'clock Monday afternoon at the parking lot of a Five Guys in South Burlington. And so the newspaper 7 days ran this by our lawyers to make sure that what I was doing was legal. And in fact, that was the point of why I was doing it. I wanted to show what can be legally done. And in fact, I called Tris up and I didn't tell him what I was doing, but I said, hey, so hypothetically, if someone were to do X, Y, and Z, it would be totally legal. He didn't know he was giving me legal advice, but he did say that what I was describing would be legal.
But is that a surprise? I mean, isn't that the way our laws in this state are designed to run? I mean, that you were following the law as we have created it in this state.
Yeah, you know, I've always sort of looked at these laws in the abstract. We hear a lot about how they work, but actually going through this process was very eye-opening to me. I guess I didn't quite understand how easy it would be. And I wanted to make sure there wasn't something I was missing. So sure enough, I show up at 5 o'clock and this guy approaches me at the agreed upon place. And we had about a 9-minute exchange. He showed me the gun in his car. My car was parked next to it, showed me how to use it. There was one part that needed to be replaced. He showed me how to do that myself. And it was like a $30 part. He gave me the gun. I gave him an envelope with $500 cash. And I drove away. It was simple as that.
And then what did you do with the gun?
Well, then we had a gun on our hands.
And
With 7 days' money, yeah. So, we figured the most prudent action would be to turn this over to the police, in part because, you know, we didn't know the origin of this gun. And, you know, were we to sell it, put it back out in the market, perhaps there could be some legal repercussions for us. So out of an abundance of caution, I basically just called up the Burlington police chief, Brandon Del Pozo, and later that evening, I brought it over to him. And we talked about it for quite some time. And this is a weapon that he was familiar with from serving in the military. So he was able to sort of walk me through how it worked. And I ended up donating it to the Queen City Police Foundation, where it will be used for training.
Paul, you're a columnist. You have some leeway that more straight-ahead journalists don't always
That's for
have.
Sure.
So put a fine point on it. It seems clear in the article you are in some ways trying to make a point. What do you think should happen with gun laws in this state?
Well, you know, one of the things I did during the day after I set up this transaction, I went over to a press conference that took place around noon that day where a number of the state's top law enforcement and political officials were speaking. And I engaged Governor Peter Shumlin on this. He has been a strong opponent of any sort of gun control, new gun control laws. And I sort of walked him through this hypothetical. Again, I hadn't done it yet. I didn't know if it would work out. But I said, you know, he says we need a 50-state solution to this problem, a position many people agree with. And I said, well, you know, I could walk down the street today, and I could buy a gun without a background check, and I could be a terrorist. I could be a, you know, I could have been convicted of domestic violence or some other crime. And he sort of looked at me and said, you know, Paul, it's not as simple as that. And I wanted to show that it was as simple as that. I think that that's very important for people to know that. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to shift the way you feel on this issue. But I think some people weren't quite aware how easy that was. I got a lot of responses, I mean, from really everywhere, but also from Vermont politicians who I don't think quite realized how easy it was. So I think
is that a willful ignorance? Excuse me for the raspy throat. I mean, is it a willful ignorance?
I don't want to accuse people of that. I mean, I think the most people don't. I should say most lawmakers aren't going out buying semi-automatic rifles in parking lots. So I guess I wouldn't expect them to know that. I would expect the governor to be aware of the law that he has been zealously protecting. I should say that there has been quite a bit of movement politically in Vermont on this issue in the last 4 years. I mean, I started reporting on this issue after Newtown, and at that point, the congressional delegation was entirely opposed to federal action on this. They have now become some of the strongest proponents of that. And in the gubernatorial race that is ongoing, we're seeing for the first time Democratic candidates, all three of them, in fact, saying that they support universal background checks. That is very new in Vermont politics.
Well, and it's very new. Excuse me. It is very new for some of these candidates as well. We had Sue Mindra on the show yesterday. Mm-hmm. She has had this in her platform. But for some of the candidates, this is a new position as well to take a stand on.
And she has evolved throughout this race. You know, last December, she was the first of these candidates to say, I support universal background checks. But it was only on Monday that she and Peter Galbraith said, we want some sort of a ban on military style weapons.
Paul Hines is a columnist for 7 Days. We have a link to his article on buying a gun through a private sale this week. You can go to vpr.net to find that link. Interesting reading. Paul, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks, Tris, for the advice.
We are talking with Tristram Coffin, former U.S. Attorney for the District of Vermont, about guns and gun sales and gun rights. And if you have a question for him, or if you'd just like to share your thoughts with us, you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. or call 1-800-639-2211. James in Perkinsville says, is it possible to deny that gun-related deaths in America are a health issue? We're in the midst of an epidemic of enormous proportions. Thousands of Americans die annually from guns, and yet our Congress refuses to allow the Centers for Disease Control, the agency charged with protecting our health, to conduct research on this vital issue. James says, this is absurd. I can only conclude that Congress has been bought and paid for by interests that do not want the facts about the effects of guns on our health examined. Enough politics. Let us get the facts. John in Cornwall says, I was born and brought up in England, where I applied for and received a firearms permit to own a 12-gauge double-barreled shotgun, which I used for pheasant, hare, and grouse hunting. As a permit holder, I was required that I had landowner's permission to hunt. When the gun was not being used, it was required to be kept locked up, and the ammunition was to be separated and locked up elsewhere. In addition, I was subject to an annual unannounced visit by police to check that I maintained the gun in a secure place. I've lived in the U.S. and have been a citizen for over 38 years. John has a number of steps that he thinks should be taken, including allow the Bureau of Tobacco, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to maintain a registration list of all gun owners on the latest computer database, not of paper records as now, and allow the CDC and others to do all the research and publish it on the whys, wherefores, and what ifs of gun ownership, deaths, accidents, etc. Let's go to Evelyn, who's calling in from Stowe. Hi, Evelyn. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. I think that we have to have big changes in the legislation and remove all semi-automatic and automatic weapons from the hands of people in this country, because that argument that this would be taking away our rights, having people who shouldn't have these guns having the guns is taking away everybody's rights, and we are all victims. And yesterday you had on the parents, Newtown, and it just broke my heart.
Oh, Evelyn, we're losing your phone line here, but I take your point, your strong point, that you think changes need to be made here. Let's go to Sharon, who's calling in from Pittsburgh, New Hampshire. Hi, Sharon. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for this informative talk on the radio today. I appreciate it. I own Highlander cattle up in Pittsburgh, New Hampshire. I also own a herd of cattle in northern Vermont. And I do own an AR-15. Reason being, when we're calving out our cows, the coyotes come in. And the coyotes will start eating the calves before they're even out of their mom. So, of course, I have to have something to shoot quickly. When there's, you know, 20 coyotes against one human, you need something good. So that's why I got the AR-15. But when I got it, I had to get the approval of the chiefs of both towns where I would be using it. And after or if I had used it, I had to inform Fish and Game what I had killed, how much ammo I had used. So it was very, very regulated, even just from a farmer's point of view. But I cannot survive without an AR-15. If they take out one calf, I'm out a little over, right around $2,000 to $3,000. So I just want to say they can be used responsibly. And I think that the status quo they went through, for I could use mine, having the police chiefs of both town okay it, I think that's kind of a good regulation. I don't know if that's a law, but I think it's a good idea.
Sharon, thanks for your call. I appreciate your perspective. Tris Coffin is still with us, and you've been listening to this whole conversation. I want to give you a chance, Tristram, to weigh in here, because you do have thoughts on this, opinions on it from your career as U.S. attorney and from your own perspective. So, you know, given what you've been hearing and where you're thinking, I'd like to know what your thoughts are.
Like the caller from Pittsburgh, New Hampshire said, you know, to me that's kind of emblematic about what we ought to be doing is talking about the reasons that different reasonable regulations on this important constitutional right need to be limited, contoured, regulated in some fashion. So we're really balancing the issues. She posed some what sound like good reasons why she needs a gun with a larger magazine than many people have. Sadly, there's many parents who've lost kids or siblings who've lost siblings or husbands who've lost wives and so forth who in these shootings who have other values. We just need to come to the table, I think, and regulate this in a way. I know we can do it. There's no real reason that reason can't prevail here, and we can't get a policy both in the state and the federal that is better than what we have now.
What would that look like, just briefly?
Well, I think, you know, some reasonable limitations on the type of weapon without particular exceptions or licenses like we have for the machine gun. Waiting periods, because more damage can happen when a gun gets into people's hands than if it's delayed, typically with some bypass, and universal background checks so that we don't have this gaping loophole in what else what otherwise is a fairly elaborate system that we've invested a lot of time and money in. Those are starters.
Tristram Coffin is a former U.S. attorney for the District of Vermont, now an attorney for Downs Racklin Martin in Burlington. Tris Coffin, thanks very much for talking with
us
today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll be speaking with VPR's Taylor Dobbs about why the state of Vermont dropped charges in one case against State Senator Norm McAllister this morning. You are listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. State Senator Norm McAllister's rape trial ended abruptly this morning as prosecutors dismissed the charges against him. The trial began yesterday in Franklin County Superior Court and included two felony counts of sexual assault. The trial was expected to be short, but the abrupt dismissal of the charges this morning was a surprise. VPR's Taylor Dobbs was covering the trial and was in the courtroom this morning. He joins us now. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, Jane.
So proceedings were scheduled to resume this morning at 8:30. What happened?
Actually, it was off to a slow start this morning. The judge wasn't coming to the bench and starting proceedings, so it was unclear what was going on and why the delay was happening. And I also watched the star witness, the person accusing Senator McAllister of these allegations. She left the building about 20 minutes before proceedings started, and it was unclear why. And then once people got in their chairs and the jury came in, the trial was over within seconds when State Prosecutor Diane Wheeler made this statement to the court.
Based on some information that came to light last evening that I've shared with the defense and the court, the state is in a position to have to dismiss counts 5 and 6.
Now, Taylor, counts 5 and 6 are the two counts that McAllister is facing in this trial, right? There are other counts that he faces in a separate trial, which involve a different set of circumstances.
That's right.
So did Wheeler explain what information came to light last night that led them to make this decision?
No, she didn't really make any other statements about that. And then as soon as it was over, she left the court and didn't take questions from the press. But Norm McAllister's defense attorney, Brooks MacArthur, did speak to the press afterwards, and He says the defense cross-examination of the witness yesterday made the state's accusations fall apart.
You heard the testimony yesterday. The case has been dismissed today. I think that speaks for itself. Obviously, we raised a number of credibility issues with the complaining witness.
And the complaining witness in this case is the alleged victim who worked for McAllister on his farm and then later as a legislative intern. And as a general policy, VPR does not disclose the names or identities of alleged victims of sexual assault cases.
Taylor, you were in court yesterday. So what did happen that might have made the state's allegations fall apart so dramatically as Brooks MacArthur alleges there?
So in the morning, the state prosecutor was interviewing the alleged victim and got a lot of very precise details about what happened, what order things happened in, things as detailed as the hair color of the victim at the time of one of the assaults. And then in the afternoon, under cross-examination, the defense pointed out a number of inconsistencies between the morning's testimony about what exactly happened and previous sworn statements made under oath by this accuser who and those statements disagreed with what she'd said in the courtroom. And so they pointed those out and it became clear that there were definitely some inconsistencies.
Can you describe some of them?
Yeah. So, for example, one of the bigger ones was the timing and location of the first sexual assault incident that was alleged. In court yesterday, the accuser said that that happened a few weeks after she started working for McAllister on his farm. And it happened in a abandoned barn near the property. And then the defense pointed to a recording of a sworn statement when she said the first assault happened on the first day of employment for McAllister in his house. So the location and timing of that were different. And then there were things like the color of her hair. As I mentioned before, she claimed that her hair was purple at the timing of the first incident in 2012. And the defense used her Facebook account and pointed out her profile pictures and showed that her hair wasn't purple till 2014.
Taylor, the defense also pointed to the fact that she hadn't made accusations before this point.
Yeah, so there was a lot of talk about you had a cell phone, you had a car and friends on Facebook and a bunch of opportunities to raise this issue with authorities or friends or people who could help. And that those opportunities were never taken advantage of. And so the defense, that point never got a chance to land, really, because the trial ended abruptly. But it became clear that they were suggesting that if all of these resources were available and there was so much opportunity to prove what was happening at the time, why didn't that get done?
But, you know, victims' advocates will say that, you know, often, first of all, there are faulty memories that victims have, and those are often used to discredit them, but don't necessarily mean that the events didn't occur. And then that often a victim's silence is taken as a point to discredit a victim, you know, or to say nothing happened because clearly you didn't mention it before. You know, what did you observe in the courtroom yesterday that about that kind of argument?
Well, that definitely seemed to be something along the lines of what the defense was pursuing. Again, we didn't really get to see the whole thing play out because it ended abruptly. But they definitely were pointing out a number of times of those discrepancies that I talked about, and also times when the accuser went back to spend time with Norm McAllister and even volunteered on his reelection campaign. And they said that that's, you know, suggests that maybe she wasn't too upset about whatever had happened before. Her explanation of those discrepancies was pretty straightforward. And here she is yesterday on the stand.
I'll put it this way. I remember the bad things that happened, but I don't remember them in order. I remember bits and pieces and things that just pop in my head, if that explains it.
And yesterday's proceedings ended with the defense still questioning that witness. And presumably today, the prosecution could have taken the chance to clarify their case and maybe drive that point home a little bit more. But instead, they dismissed the charges as soon as proceedings started this morning. And it's important to note here that that dismissal was with prejudice, which means that these allegations can't be brought again against McAllister.
Taylor, McAllister's arrest at the State House a year ago in May was pretty dramatic. And we know that sexual assault allegations often don't even go to trial. The events of the last year seem to have public opinion, at least, really forming against McAllister. And all of that makes the dismissal this morning pretty shocking. So was there any indication before this morning that the case really wasn't as going very well for the prosecution?
Well, it was definitely clear during the cross-examination yesterday that that was a setback for prosecutors. And there was also, throughout the day yesterday, some confusion about witnesses. A number of people, including lawmakers and journalists, had been subpoenaed to testify before the court, and they were released with really no explanation. I spoke with Senator Jeanette White at lunch yesterday, and she said she had been released that morning but had no idea why. And there was also some speculation because the prosecutors were relying on testimony from journalists, which typically isn't done, that some people speculated that maybe that was evidence that their case was a little bit weak.
So what happens next? We mentioned at the beginning of the interview that there is another case against McAllister.
So the court scheduled a status conference for about a month from now where both sides are going to meet with the court and figure out a schedule for the coming trial. Those charges have not been dropped, and it's currently expected that that trial is going to go on as expected. But at this point, we're waiting for that status conference and then maybe a trial later this summer.
And that's for one charge of felony sexual assault and three prohibited acts. And McAllister is proclaiming his innocence in that charge as well.
That's right.
VPR's Taylor Dobbs. Thanks, Taylor.
Thank you.
We have more on this story. Go to VPR.net for all of our coverage. Senator Bernie Sanders is giving a live web stream address tonight that could reveal the next steps in his presidential campaign. His opponent in the Democratic primary, Hillary Clinton, is now the presumed nominee. But Sanders still wants to exert influence on the party and its platform. In the meantime, Democrats and many Republicans are growing more alarmed by the statements of the presumptive Republican nominee, Donald Trump. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll look at Bernie Sanders' role in the ever-changing landscape of the presidential race. Be sure to tune in for that live tomorrow at noon. Send your thoughts to Vermont Edition at VPR.net. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.